Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live with MJ, where I have the distinct pleasure to interview some of the greatest names in sports, entertainment, food, and lifestyle, as well as philanthropy. For those of you who are first-time listeners, my name is MJ. I am the president and founder of Interpublic Relations, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Gina Mason. Hello, Gina.
Hello, MJ. How's it going?
Oh, things are great. I am looking forward to speaking with Tony Richardson today.
I know. I'm really excited. I'm excited to hear what he has to say, not only about his philanthropy, but everything else that he's working on. And, you know, with the Jets, they still have their playoff hopes. So I'm really excited to talk to him.
Well, today our special guest is retired NFL veteran, turned sports analyst, and activist humanitarian, Tony Richardson. Welcome, Tony. It is such an
honor.
Hello,
how are we doing?
Oh, great. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today. But before we jump into our interview, I just want to share some of your impressive achievements with some of our listeners. During Tony's illustrious 16-season NFL career, he played fullback for the Kansas City Chiefs, Minnesota Vikings, and New York Jets, and is recognized as one of the best fullbacks to ever play in the league. And yes, I do use the word the best. He was the Chiefs' leading rusher in 2000, and from 2001 to 2009, he blocked for 8 1,000-yard seasons. He played in 3 Pro Bowls, was named a 2-time All-Pro season team selection, and was also named to the NFL 2000 All-Decade Team. In addition to his excellence on the field, Tony was also recognized for his philanthropic efforts, being named Pro Football Weekly's Arthur S. Arkush Humanitarian of the Year, that's a mouthful, excuse me, and was voted an NFL Good Guy in 2002, 2003, and 2004 by the Sporting News. In 2005, Tony received the Distinguished Citizens Award from the National Conference for Community and Justice, an organization dedicated to fighting bias, bigotry, and racism. He was selected by NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell to the 6-member Players Advisory Committee in spring 2007, and in 2008 was named Walter Payton Man of the Year for the Jets. In 2010, Tony was named the Jets Man of the Year and won the NFLPA's Byron Wizzer White Award. Currently, he is working as a sports analyst for SNY, covering the Jets, and is very active with a number of charitable organizations, including his own nonprofit, the Rich in Spirit Foundation. And that is just the cliff notes, folks. Tony, wow, what an introduction. Jeez, I'm exhausted.
I know. I need you to every day. That's
well, certainly congratulations on all of that. But let's start from the beginning. You were born in Germany on a U.S. military base. What was that like growing up as an Army brat living in Germany as a child?
You know, it was actually it was great. It was a learning experience for me, you know, just because of the simple fact that, you know, growing up in a military base and basically traveling every 2 to 3 years, it really taught me about, you know, how to be a people person, how to, you know, relate to a lot of different people from different cultures because, you know, every time I was always the new kid in school. So we spent, you know, time in Germany, we come back to the States and we go back to Germany and then back and forth. And I was always the kid that had to stand up and say, hey, my name is Tony Richardson. This is where I'm from. You know, this is what my dad does and all that kind of stuff. And so I think it helped me out a lot culturally. And so I think that really is when I first started to understand how important it was to give back. Just simple from the simple fact that, you know, when I go into a situation, I don't look and say, well, you know, this person's white or this person's black or this person's Hispanic. I'm more so just walk into it and just try to address the needs. And I think that's what really helped me a lot as far as like breaking down a lot of, you know, cultural barriers is just because I grew up with a bunch of kids from a lot of different backgrounds and all things like that. So that was a great upbringing for me.
I mean, that is awesome. And you know what, not to compare, but I see, you know, being a mom here in Manhattan, New York City, it's somewhat similar. My son has so many friends that are from different ethnic backgrounds, and I think it's awesome because when I grew up in a predominantly white Caucasian area. And although, you know, there are some, I won't say similarities, no, because that's not the proper word, but there are some things with, you know, growing up with just one, but you really can't speak the amount of volumes about growing up with different diversity in your life. I mean, that's just awesome, and I actually do wish I had that growing up. So that's great, and kudos to you.
And What's even more, and I just think this is so amazing. So you didn't start playing football until you moved to the U.S. when you were in high school, which is just incredible considering your outstanding professional career. And you received a Division I scholarship to Auburn, and, you know, you became the second running back ever to start as a freshman right behind Bo Jackson. So how, I know so many people, you know, they want their kids to get into sports and have that hope and dream to get a scholarship to play, you know, Division I sports. How did you accomplish such a feat after having a later start than most college football players, and what was your training regimen like?
Yeah, I think it's I think there's plus and minuses to both sides. I think that, you know, obviously sports has been a huge part of my life, and I think, you know, kids that start at an early age, it definitely teaches you, a lot of things in life as far as like discipline, how to work in a team environment, you know, how to submit to authority, responsibility, and all those things. I think all those traits are good for young kids. For me, because my dad was in the military, I got that from a different standpoint, to where it was no nonsense and it was all about business. And so I think that's where I got a lot of that from. And so once I really started, you know, to play football, really the only reason I ever went out to play football is because when I came from Germany, I grew up playing soccer. So when I came from Germany, most of all the kids I wanted to be friends with were guys who were athletes and guys who were playing. And so I went out and tried it out. And, you know, one thing my dad always told me is that anything you do, you know, do it with all your might and give 100%. And so I think once I really started to understand the game, and, you know, we brought in a new head coach down in Daleville, Alabama, small town where we got planted. And he really just taught me a lot about, like, you know, how to, like, really create balance in your life. And so, you know, my academics was always first. I had a job in high school, and then everything else was about, you know, trying to be the best athlete I could be. So I think having all three of those, that combination, and having, you know, parents that were very supportive, I think that's what really helped me, to achieve a college scholarship. And for me, my parents have always been very supportive and great. And so that was probably one of the happiest days of my life when I knew I could take that financial burden of getting a college scholarship and not having to have my parents pay for college. And so that was a big point in my life.
Wow, that's really awesome. But do you think that having a later start in the game is why you were able to stay healthy and have such a long career?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of it is, it was no pressure. So I think sometimes, and I see this a lot now when I go to, like, you know, some of my friends who have kids, and I'm sitting there just as an innocent bystander, and I kind of see, like, or you hear the parents, and the parents are trying to live their career or their career they didn't have through their kids, and I think they put a lot of pressure on kids, and I don't think that's right, because the biggest thing, I think when I went out and started playing, it was fun, and it wasn't like the time I was 6 years old and I said, hey, I'm going to the NFL, and I put all my stock into going to the NFL. So I think once I started playing, it was fun to me. And then once I started getting serious about it, you know, then it became a motivation, because I said, okay, through sports and academics, you know, I can get a college scholarship. And that's really what, I think that's really what drove me. And that's what, you know, even as I started to get later in my NFL career, it was still fun. I mean, I was still, you know, had the same work ethic, the still, I guess, kid-like joy, but it was never really like a lot of pressure. I mean, obviously professional sports is a lot of pressure, but I didn't really feel that, because it really wasn't, not saying I didn't love every minute of it, but it wasn't like a dream where it was like I threw all my eggs in one basket and the only thing I had was just to play football, to play sports. And so I think that's what really, you know, motivated me to play as long as I did.
And I think that's so true. I mean, you see so many athletes out there that are just so talented, you know, in the high school and junior high school level, and their parents are so hard on them. They don't have that support that it's detrimental to their career, and they just get burnt out and they stop having fun. And I think having fun is probably the most important thing, whether you're playing sports or, you know, you're working your career. If you're not having fun, then you're not doing it right.
Right. I think they lose sight of the sport and start just so much pressure. I mean, absolutely, especially because colleges are so expensive. So you're very, very fortunate. And by the way, we have to congratulate you. You were recently inducted into State of Alabama Sports Hall of Fame, as well as Auburn Football Hall of Fame. That is such an honor. What does that mean to you to be recognized by your alma mater in the state of Alabama?
You know, it was one of those very humbling when I first got the call, and you know, the fact that when they said I was going to get inducted into the Alabama Sports Hall of Fame, just because, you know, you look at the fullback position, and obviously it's kind of like a dying breed. And so you really don't play fullback to make it to the Hall of Fame, because the likelihood of making it to the Hall of Fame as a fullback is probably slim to none. And so for me, it was just you know, I went when I actually had a chance to go down to Birmingham and take a tour and to see some of the names in there, you know, guys that I looked up to, you know, Bo Jackson and, you know, Joe Namath and, you know, Bear Bryant. I see all these names in there and Derek Thomas and Charles Barkley and, you know, the list goes on. And I'm sitting there like, I really don't belong here. I mean, it was very humbling. And then obviously a couple of weeks ago, you know, to be able to be recognized at Auburn and have my parents there and, you know, my sisters and, you know, my nephew and have all my family to be there to, you know, because it's just one of those things that, you know, I look back on my life, I look back on my career, and it's like, you know, how did a small town kid from Daleville, Alabama, you know, end up and get recognized in a major school like Auburn? And it was very humbling to just to be able to stand on that field and just acknowledge the fans, you know, one more time and just say thank you for, you know, thank Auburn for all they've, you know, been able to, you know, do in my life and my career and really help me mold me into the man I am today.
Well, you know what? You certainly deserve it, Tony. I mean, you have such a great story and such great accomplishments. So, again, congratulations.
And, you know, let's talk about your post-college career. So, you know, after you got out of college, you got picked up by the Dallas Cowboys, an undrafted free agent, and spent your rookie season on the practice squad. You know, you talked a lot about, you know, your drive and your hard work, and you know, you really made a name for yourself, the league. You didn't let that, you know, the fact that you didn't get drafted stop you from going after your dream. Do you think that experience helped shape your work, you know, the rest of your career and the success you had with the Chiefs, the Vikings, and the Jets?
Yeah, I think it absolutely did. You know, I think, you know, obviously there was a disappointment. So my senior year, we were 11-0, which was, you know, really hard to do in the SEC at that time. But because we were on probation, we really didn't get a lot of notoriety. So really every single game we went into, you know, it was kind of like us against the world. And then all of a sudden when it was time for, like, the draft and everything else, a lot of the players on our team, no one really got recognized. We ended up having Wayne Gandy, who went first round to the Rams, and James Bostic went third round. And I believe that was the only two guys that really got drafted from an undefeated team. And so, you know, initially they were saying, hey, you know, I might get drafted anywhere between third and fifth round. And all of a sudden all the rounds go by and my name doesn't get called. So initially there was a little bit of disappointment. And, you know, I remember my agent called me and basically just saying, like, hey, you got an opportunity to go to the Dallas Cowboys. They had just won back-to-back Super Bowls. You get a chance to work with Troy Aikman, Emmitt Smith, you know, Daryl Johnson, you know, all those guys, you know, Michael Irvin. And I was like, you know what, I'm going to take this as a learning opportunity. And from that point on, I just kept putting my nose to the grind and, you know, kept working hard. And then going to Kansas City and having Marcus Allen in the classroom, you know, they both of those two running backs, Emmitt and Marcus, really taught me about how to be a pro and how to take care of your body both on and off the field.
God, I mean, listen, you can't get better names than the ones that you have just mentioned, so. Most can't say those names. Good for you. And we have John from New Jersey has emailed us a question for you. And he wants to know, looking back on your career, is there one play or game that stands out in your mind? And secondly, is there one play or game that fans approach you about when they meet you in person?
Yeah, I think there's two. So I think about had a tremendous amount of respect, and obviously, you know, my buddy Tony Gonzalez. So we basically had an all-star, you know, offensive team with Trent Green and Dante Hall and Tony Gonzalez and, you know, Priest Holmes. And the thing about it is, like, we have all these good records, but every time we got to the playoffs, we'd always come up short. So I never won a playoff game until I signed with the New York Jets. And so I remember that first feeling of, you know, having a chance to play in the playoffs and then winning that playoff game to advance. And that was the first, you know, that was the first time that you know, I've ever experienced that in my career. So, you know, when we had a chance to play in an AFC Championship game, I mean, that was, you know, I was all in just because, you know, I had never experienced that before. And, you know, it wasn't an individual goal. It was a team goal. And we worked hard and we busted our butt and we did it together. And so that was probably one of the, you know, best games that I can remember, you know, from that standpoint. And then I think from another standpoint where a lot of fans kind of recognize our Auburn year. So we were 10-0. And Alabama was 9-1, and Alabama had basically been taking us to the woodshed for my freshman year. And so our senior year comes, and it's like, you know, the much vaunted, you know, Alabama, we're playing in our backyard. We win this game, we have a chance to be undefeated. And I remember it was like a lead play, and I was a fullback, and James Bostic was the tailback. And I remember hitting the linebacker and just felt James Bostic just sprint by me. And at that point, I looked up, and he was just off to the races for a touchdown. And so basically what happened is I basically took my helmet off and just run it out. That's before you could take it. That was before you got a penalty for taking your helmet off. And so I took my helmet off and just dove, as soon as he stood in the end zone, I just dove at him. And basically, he said that was the hardest he had been hit all year long. And so, you know, all the Auburn fans still remember that play. You know, very very near and dear to their heart.
I have one more question too. We have Tim from Connecticut. What is the best? What was the best rivalry that you experienced? Was it with Alabama and Auburn, or is it one in the NFL? What was the best rivalry?
Yeah, by far it's Alabama Auburn. It's you know, it's probably one of the longest standing rivals. You know, and not in college sports, but I think in all sports. I mean, I look at our years in Kansas City. I mean, we had some big rivalries against. You know, obviously against the Raiders, and then coming to New York, you know, playing against the Patriots. The Alabama-Auburn game is one day literally where the entire state just shuts down. I mean, if you were going to rob somebody or do something illegal, do it on everything.
You won't get caught.
You won't get caught at all. But, yeah, that's the rivalry that, you know, that sticks out. And like I said, for my first 3 years, we, you know, Alabama was very good, and they beat us. And so to have the opportunity to beat them my senior year and to go undefeated, I look back at that rivalry, and it still holds a special place in my heart.
I bet. I mean, I can't even imagine I went to mid-level school, but I mean, to be able to go to a school and experience and have these die-hard fans that, I mean, that has to be the coolest thing as a college player.
And the adrenaline.
Oh, my gosh.
That's so exciting.
Okay, we have one more. We'll go one more with a question from Richie from Staten Island. He said, what are your feelings about Bama's program, and do you think that it's going to take your Auburn Tigers to beat them in the Iron Bowl next year? Or excuse me, what is it going to take for them to beat the Tigers next year in the Iron Bowl?
You mean, what do I think about Auburn beating the
Bama, yeah.
Oh, you know, it's going to take a lot. I mean, and it's even funny this year. Like, obviously they were, I think they were the much better team this year. But yet still, we played them extremely hard and extremely tough just because it's a rivalry game. I think next year we're definitely going to be a lot better football team just because our quarterback this year, Jeremy Johnson, was young, first year starting. So now he's going to have an extra year under his belt. I think there's some things we got to shore up on defense. But, you know, like I said, when you get to that game, you know, basically you can throw the records out. And, you know, it's obviously going to be in Tuscaloosa next year because this year was in Auburn. And I just, you know, I really feel good about our season coming up next year just because, you know, having a quarterback now that's had 1 year under his belt, he's only going to get better.
Awesome. So, Tony, as I mentioned earlier, you have been a very active humanitarian and received a number of awards for all of your philanthropic efforts. How does it feel to receive such praise and recognition?
You know, you kind of look back on it, and you not even look back on it. It's like, you know, I'm still in the middle of it, especially now with the holiday season. And it's, you know, I think it's something that we should do. And I think, you know, you really shouldn't get awards in that. I mean, the fact that sometimes people do recognize you for that is great, but I think that's our civic duty. You know, if you see someone who's a little down in their luck or someone who may need a helping hand, I mean, you know, if you're able to do it, and it doesn't necessarily have to be about money. It's just about, it could be time. It could be just spending time with someone at a children's hospital or, you know, obviously donating turkeys for Thanksgiving. So whatever you can do to just kind of give back, I think it's our civic responsibility. And I think I learned a lot of that from just, you know, watching my dad, you know, being a military man and watching my sister who's still currently serving our country now. Just an act of service. I mean, even as a kid, my parents would have, like, some of the younger soldiers over the house, and we would cook Thanksgiving dinner and, you know, give back to people. And so I kind of learned that at an early age. And so I think it's, you know, it's very humbling that people would recognize you for that, but I think it's something that we all should, you know, all should do if we're capable of.
No, absolutely. You know, and you did discuss with us a few weeks ago when we met, we talked about, you know, your dad being a veteran, but since you just brought up your sister, you mentioned a really sweet sentiment about her, and you told us that she is your hero. I would love for you to share with all the fans that are listening a little bit about who she is and what she's doing now.
Yeah, so she's a tough girl. I mean, she's been through, you know, Fort Benning Jump School. She's been to Desert Storm. She just got back from Afghanistan. Really raising my nephew. He's, you know, 21 years old now and sophomore in college. Transferred to Auburn next year and just been a good kid, never got in trouble, making good grades. And so I look at her and I look at, you know, just the sacrifice that she's made for not only our country but for our family. And so, yeah, she's definitely my hero and someone that, you know, if I'm having a bad day, I just think about, you know, the times where my sister was in Afghanistan. And see, I remember this trip, you know, more importantly because this was the first time in my career that I actually had time to actually go off and go down there and see her off. And I was basically like, okay, I'll help you pack. And I was like, okay, what kind of clothes are you going to pack? She's like, basically, for 6 months, you can wear no civilian clothes. And so I'm sitting there, I'm like, so every single day she has to wear a military uniform.
Oh, boy.
That's just amazing. And, you know, with all the craziness going on in the world, and, you know, we'll touch on that.
Like that. And
talk about
that.
Go ahead, Tony.
Hello?
Sorry. Yes, go ahead.
Oh,
sorry.
No problem. So you just look at that, and, you know, she's definitely my hero and someone that, you know, I definitely, you know, really look up to.
Wow, what a special lady. I hope when she does come back, we have the honor of meeting her.
Yes.
I will leave that to you to make that happen.
So she's back stateside now. So she's back, definitely back home, and she's in Fort Knox, Kentucky now. So hopefully, maybe after the holidays, she'll come up to New York and visit.
Oh, that's awesome.
That. And, you know, with the crazy world that we live in right now, there's just not, and you know, getting to spend time with you on Veterans Day on the double-decker bus with our client Ben and Jack, it was such a great experience, and it was very humbling, you know, for people that aren't really around our veterans and don't understand the sacrifice that they truly make. And, you know, you, your sister and your father are a testament to that. And, you know, you just can't thank them enough for all that they do. And, you know, what was your experience like when you came with us to pay homage to the soldiers on Veterans Day?
Did you let your family know that you, I'm sure you did, but tell us
I was trying to get them to watch the parade, and they were able to tune in online. They actually missed me. I guess they missed us when we rode by. But yeah, it was very, you know, for me to be a part of that parade was, you know, really just to say thank you, to our troops, who just, you know, really, you started looking about it. You know, obviously we're living in some very tough times now, and, you know, there's so much craziness going on in our world, and, you know, obviously everything's not perfect, but just the fact that there's soldiers out there and there's police officers out there and there's, you know, firefighters there who really put their life on the line. And they, you know, unfortunately people call athletes, you know, role models and heroes. And those are our true role models and heroes. And that's what allows us to have the freedoms that we do have. And so the fact that we can, you know, celebrate them, to me every day is Veterans Day. I mean, because we can celebrate them every day. There's a lot of veterans who, you know, my dad was a Vietnam veteran, and I remember, you know, obviously I wasn't born then, but him, you know, telling me stories about, you know, coming back and not being welcome and no thank you and things of that nature. So every chance I get for sure, I always make it a point if I see a person in uniform just to say, hey, thank you for your service. So it was very important for me to be there, and, you know, I really appreciate you guys including me in that day.
Tony, we need more people like you.
Yeah.
We really do. You're just awesome.
Well, listen, now we adopted. That's going to be our annual thing, Tony. So you know where you're going to be.
Come in.
All right. But I want to talk about your Roots and Spirit Foundation and the Dictionary Project. Tell us about that.
So the Roots and Spirit Foundation, I started it when I was in Kansas City. And I when people say, well, you know, Roots and Spirit, like, kind of explain what it means. And so basically what I didn't want to put all my baskets. And so basically I kind of looked at, obviously, the name Rich for my name, but spirit is a spirit of giving. It's a spirit of expansion, and you can do so many different things. And so when I designed my foundation, basically I kind of wanted to create it to, you know, my mission statement is to really, you know, help, you know, people help kids through education who have low to no income, because I know education in my life played a big part. So anything I can do to try to, you know, if it's a back to school drive, or if it's a dictionary project, or, you know, anything I can do to backpack drive, you know, things like that. Because, you know, one thing we understand is, like, even little kids, they have pride, and kids a lot of times won't take their school supplies to school if they don't have a nice book bag. So the little thing of just giving a kid a book bag and saying, hey, this is yours, you know, put your books in it, feel pride, you know, have pride about it. And that kind of gives them, like, a sense of purpose and a sense of, you know, they're driven when they go to school. And so that's kind of what my foundation really is all about. There's so many other things that I'm involved in. You know, I do holiday parties with Children's Village, which is something that's near and dear to my heart here in the New York City area. A lot of these boys have, their families have given up on them. They've either been physically, mentally, emotionally abused. And so, you know, I just try to do anything I can to live my time around my resources to, you know, help the community in which I live. So, you know, I'm involved in a lot of different things, and my dad always tells me that we all have 24 hours in a day, and it's really up to you to decide how you spend yours. And so I try to spend a lot of my day just helping out as many people as I can.
Oh, that's awesome. That's so special to hear. It really is.
And you're also involved with a lot of local charities in addition to what the awesome work that you're doing with Rich in Spirit, including Big Brothers Big Sisters and Autism Speaks. So you know, we kind of touched on this, but really, what inspires you to pay it forward and to give back?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it is just the fact that, you know, I think I look at my upbringing and I think that, you know, as a kid, like I never really played sports, but, you know, there are a lot of kids who do look up to athletes. And so, you know, I remember as a kid, I never got a chance to meet a professional athlete. So any chance I get, if it's going into a school, you know, in school visits to give a kid an encouraging word or anything like that, it's because, you know, these kids, they do look up to us and they do hold us in high regard. And I remember a situation in Kansas City when I was getting ready, leaving in Kansas City to go to the Minnesota Vikings. And I remember this, you know, I was in a grocery store. This guy came up to me and it was, you know, I generally grocery shop late at night. So he comes up to me and he's like, "Hey, are you Tony Richardson?" And I said, "Yes." And he starts telling me this story and he starts tearing up. He says, "Well, you came to my daughter's school and you gave her a dictionary and you told her to put her name in it and take it wherever she goes." He said, "Now every single night when she goes to bed, she sleeps with a dictionary." And so he was like, he said, "As a parent, I can tell my daughter that every single day and she would never listen. But the fact that you came to her school and took the time, and that's when you really realize, like, you really can make a difference with a pat on the back, an encouraging word, a dictionary, or, you know, even if it's, you know, giving a dollar to a child, whatever it might be that you can do to help out. I mean, you really don't understand the impact you have in young people's lives. And so that's why it's very important to me as much as I can to, you know, give back and help as many people as I can."
That's such a sweet story.
That is such a sweet story. Oh, my goodness. You know, if I wasn't married, Tony, I should have sleep you up your feet. So, since, you know, education seems to be a big part of who you are. And with this in mind, we came across a very powerful quote by which I'd like to share with the rest of the audience. You say, "It is great to be an inspiring football player, to be a Hall of Fame, Pro Bowler, or to win a Super Bowl, but it's most important to invest in yourself, invest in your future with education." Any advice to share with the fans who are listening, who are in school, who may be having a tough time when it comes to getting good grades, what can you say to inspire them?
Yeah, I would just say continue to see it through. I mean, the one thing about it was, you know, I was very fortunate to, you know, get my undergrad degree and then go back to graduate school. But, you know, it wasn't like I was just a brilliant kid. Like, I had to work extremely hard. And I think that if you're willing to put the work in, you know, and there's so many resources that's available, especially nowadays, like the invention of the internet and Google and all that stuff. There's so much information that's out there, and it's so easy to get. So just spend the time and invest in yourself, because, you know, that's one thing that my parents would always say. I mean, football is great, sports are great. All that could be over in one instance with one injury or one setback, where your education is something that you carry for the rest of your life. And that's what's going to carry you through the rest of your life. I mean, you know, I talk to kids all the time, and, you know, great, everybody wants to be LeBron James and everyone wants to make a bunch of money. But I'm like, okay, there's a lot of things that come along with that. Like, you know, how are you going to manage your money? How are you going to, you know, balance a checkbook? Like, all those kind of things that, you know, as a young person, you don't really think about, but everything comes into play. So I would say, you know, invest in yourself now. And, you know, it's the best thing you have to, you know, and I'm still a guy who still likes to read a lot now, and I still, you know, currently trying to invest in myself and learn as much as I possibly can.
No, that's awesome. And you know, it's so difficult. I feel like there's so much pressure on these kids today, education-wise, and I just keep telling them, you know, you don't have to go for the straight A's. Stay in school, learn as much as you can, and just try. You have to try, and they do have so many available resources. So it wasn't back in the day when we were going to school, it was a lot more difficult. But another topic I do have to touch on, because it seems like the emails are flooding in about concussions. And I will say, my son, who's now playing a lot of youth sports, I do not want him playing football for this very reason. So concussions in football and contact sports is such a hot issue, and research revealing the effects of brain trauma and CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. How do you think this will affect the game of football and the NFL in the coming years?
Yeah, you know what? It's interesting. That movie, Concussion with Denzel, is coming out on Christmas Day. And I think it's definitely going to have an impact because, you know, I mean, you see that movie, especially if you see something on the big screen, and you take everything, you know, to be true. And obviously there's a lot of information that, you know, when I first got into football, you know, we didn't know anything about CTE. We didn't know anything. Really, we didn't even really know what a concussion was. I mean, basically, you know, if you came out and you were seeing the stars, they would give you smelling salt and put you right back in the game. So now we're getting smarter. You know, I think there's a lot more education out there now. I think, you know, coaches, the program that the NFL Institute is called Heads Up. And so really what it is just, you know, making sure you see what you hit, making sure you try to take the head out of the game. So it's a lot safer. And I'm glad that we're learning a lot more. I mean, it's something that obviously every parent's going to have to make that decision and say, you know, would you allow your child to play, you know, soccer? Because soccer is technically a contact sport. We saw from the World Cup, you know, a player, you know, basically had to keep playing, which was absurd. You definitely see it in football. You see it in lacrosse. You see it in hockey. So, you know, you as a parent, you definitely have to make that decision of when do you think it's safe for your, you know, your own personal child to play.
Right.
Yeah, concussions are, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, if you've had one and you've experienced it, it's tough. And, I mean, having had one personally, I've had effects that have lasted, you know, a long time. And it's scary, but, you know, it's football's one of those big games that I don't know if it's so ingrained in American culture. I have a hard time seeing it, you know, fading away.
You know, I had a little conversation with Matt Zuccarello quickly at an event recently. He plays for the New York Rangers, and I asked him what he felt about that, and he said, you know, and of course, you know, he's quick to defend the sport, and he said, it could happen in any sport.
Mm-hmm.
He said, someone could be playing basketball and get, you know, pushed really hard and, you know, slam his head on the ground. So, and I know more so with football, but, yeah, it could happen anytime. So, unfortunately, let's just pray that those things never happen anymore.
I mean, you even think about it, just like, you know, I grew up, riding skateboards and, you know, freestyle bike ride. And, you know, obviously nowadays,
right,
you know, you should wear a helmet and all those things. But even as a kid, I didn't wear a helmet. How many times did I fall and hit my head? So, you're almost going to have to wrap your child in bubble wrap to make sure that, he doesn't fall down. I think it's like you said, like I've known people who just, you know, slipped on a curb and fell down and hit their head and got a concussion. So it's, you know, it's one of those things. I'm just glad that there's so much more research out there now to where even if the common person falls down and is not feeling well and starting having headaches, so they can go to the doctor and they can say, hey, this is a concussion and this is what you need to do and this is how you take care of yourself. Because, you know, 15, 20 years ago, I mean, it was, you got up and you saw stars for a while and you went back to doing what you were doing and it wasn't even.
Yeah, my coach used to say, rub some dirt on it. It's
fine. I know, exactly. Yep.
So when we met with you a few weeks ago, we had a really great conversation about the Legends program and what you're doing to help, you know, NFL vets who are trying to get back into the community after their post-career. And, you know, you've kind of been a mentor to them. So would you mind just walking us through some of the great work you're doing with the Legends and why it's so important to help these players when they get out of the league?
Yeah, so basically the Legends program has been around now for a little over 2 years. And so Roger Goodell, the commissioner, and Tracy have done an outstanding job of, you know, one, I kind of, you know, identifying players that would be, you know, good representatives for this program. And so really, my region is the Northeast region coordinator, and my two teams are the Jets and the Giants. So any player that's played 1 year or more with either organization, they kind of fall under my program. And we termed it Legend because we looked, you know, what we started to see is, you know, unfortunately, there was a lot of guys that, you know, maybe only played one year, 2 years, or 3 years, and they kind of felt like that the NFL did them wrong and things of that nature. And we said, you know what, if you play 1 year in the league, if you play 2 years, I mean, you're a legend. I mean, you got a chance to do something that really not a lot of people in the world get a chance to do. And so really what we want to do is we want to be a resource available, and we want to tell you about all the benefits that are available to you if it's continuing education or if it's an internship or if it's, you know, having someone sit down and explain to you your 401k or your annuity. Or it could be, I mean, there's obviously serious issues. There's, you know, I think it's issues that all men and all people deal with in transition. I mean, it can be, you know, having to have that tough conversation, you know, with your spouse and saying, hey, you know what, we were able to live this lifestyle, you know, while we were playing, but now we probably have to take a step backwards. And that's not an easy conversation to have in any household. So, you know, how do you deal with that? Now, I'm not, you know, geared to do that, but I can put you in contact with a person that, you know, a counselor that can. And maybe it's something to where, you know, you might be having some depression issues or whatever it might be. And, you know, because unfortunately we, you know, we hear about the horror stories of, you know, Junior Seau and, you know, the, you know, depression and, you know, people who've been on top of the world for so long. And then, you know, all of a sudden the career is over. And a lot of guys, and I talk to guys, and they equate it, you know, almost like a divorce. I mean, it's like everything's riding high, and all of a sudden that day it's over. I mean, there's no more phone calls. It's, you know, now when you make a dinner reservation, it's like, oh yeah, you used to play. You know, it's so, you know, you're dealing from the present, you're dealing from the present tense to the past tense, and a lot of times people have, you know, issues with that. So so my job is just to, you know, be that guy and really to be a point person to, you know, put the guys in contact with you know, whatever resources that are available. And this is one program I'm really proud about because it's the NFLPA, it's the NFL jointly, and it's not about the NFL getting the credit. It's not about the NFL Players Association getting the credit. It's about helping the player that needs the help and getting the resources that's available. So it's, I mean, I wake up every day and I'm excited to, you know, to be in this role.
That's so awesome. And, you know, it's sad because we see so many athletes that, you know, like, that they don't have the right people around them and they don't have, you know, someone to go to after their career. And, you know, you see that they're bankrupt and they, you know, they can't find work. And it's just so sad because, you know, they were such a big figure for so long. And it's great that you're leading this and spearheading this because it's just, it's such a great program. And other, I don't think other leagues, not very many other leagues, you know, professional leagues have anything like this in place to take care of their own.
It's almost like a player for players.
And
it's great because, again, you don't have the right resources. And it does seem like that once an athlete isn't in the spotlight anymore, that people move on to, you know, bigger and better. And it's really sad because we see that all the time. We have a lot of guys turn to us. And, you know, we're fortunate that we have a lot of great resources around us to, you know, refer them for many different things. But it really is sad because we've seen a lot of people, and as you know, they go bankrupt and they just don't, you know how to make a go of it. It's really sad. But we have to talk about last week's game. We have to talk about the Jets and the Giants last week. And the overtime.
The Giants.
I can't believe what I saw there. Oh, my goodness. So do you think that was the boost they needed, the Jets, to power those
teams
for the next four games? Yeah, you
think
so?
Think about it. I think the last time that the Jets actually beat the Giants in the regular season, I think it was 1993 or some crazy statistic. And this is a game where even me as a former player, like, and a former Jets player, you know, games like this in the past, somehow or another, we would have found a way to lose that game. And so the fact that, you know, they hung in there and they stayed the course, you know, got the game to overtime and was able to, you know, to win that game, I think, because you need, I mean, obviously there's always one or two games in the course of a season that all of a sudden it brings the entire team together. And I think, you know, to see those guys, you know, high-fiving in the locker room and picking each other up and, you know, and obviously you can't just rest. Yeah, you can't really rest all your laurels on that one particular game, but that's a momentum booster because now they're basically in the driver's seat, and as long as they keep winning, they can, you know, they make the playoffs, and so and they have all the intangibles. I think Fitzpatrick's playing great. Brandon Marshall's playing out of his mind. Pretty Boy Decker's obviously, you know, doing his thing. So it everything's coming together.
I love
at the
Eric
right
Decker.
Time. I think everyone listening to the show, I think everyone loves Eric Decker.
Well, I don't even want to tell you how many emails people are, like, they're writing in about Eric Decker now that we're talking about it. But we won't go there.
Sure.
I have a question. So, you know, this is the second time the Jets are going to be playing the Bills. Last game is against the Bills, your former coach, Rex Ryan. And, you know, Sexy Rexy has done some not nice things to the Jets by picking up, you know, the guy, you know, in the face. What do you think that game, as a player, I guess, how do you go into a game like that? You know, it's high adrenaline, you know, you got the rivalry with Rex, and, you know, their playoff hopes are on the line. How do you think the Jets can prep for that last, well, the rest, the next four games, that last game in particular?
Yeah, that's one game. You know, a lot of the guys, and we always say, you know, one game at a time, and, you know, don't look for it. But there's no way possible you can't have that game already circled on your schedule. So you got to take care. Well, first of all, take care of the next three games to make that a meaningful game. Because if there's a mishap and, you know, they lose two of the next three or something like that, then that game really won't be as important. But if they take care of their business and go down into that game, that's basically like playing in the Super Bowl. Because if you win, you're gonna make it to the playoffs, and then that gives you an opportunity to keep moving forward. And there's a lot of bad blood there now, and obviously for a lot of reasons. And so. That game there, I mean, that might be one game that the road, even though it's in Buffalo and it's going to be late in December, I think I might have to make that trip down to catch that game. So that's going to be an all-out street fight.
It's going to be a game to watch. And, you know, people have mixed feelings about Rex now in New York. You know, people either love him or hate him. As a player, I know he's a player's coach. What was your experience like with him?
You know, I actually love Rex. I mean, Rex and I, we still, you know, we still have a great relationship. We still talk to one another. And, you know, he was just, you know, we really related to each other a lot. I think that, you know, Rex was the type of coach where it really wasn't, I'm not going to say there really wasn't a lot of rules. But if you were a player that you took care of your business, you came to work on time, you worked hard, you busted your butt on the field, off the field, in the classroom, then, you know, he really had issues with you. And so that's just, you know, how I was raised. And so my dad was the same way. Like, as long as I took care of my business, you know, did my chores, did what I had to do, saying I didn't have rules in the household, but he allowed me to really, you know, grow as a person. And I think that's what, you know, Rex does a great job of. He allows each player to be their own individual. And it's not like a soundbite where everybody's saying the exact same thing to the exact same question. Like, Rex allows you to be who you are. For me, as a veteran player, I loved it. Now, sometimes that don't work so well with, like, younger players because sometimes they just, you know, they don't know that they don't know and they just start talking too much. And but Rex, he was a perfect coach for me at that time of my career.
Well, that's awesome to hear. That's great. So we have one last question, and it's just for fun. Actually, it's three. We want to know who your favorite player is, the favorite, meaning athlete, of course, favorite city you played in, and your favorite restaurant here in New York City since you're living here.
Oh, man, that's tough. Let me see. My favorite current player right now would probably have to be, oh, man, that's a tough one. Any sport?
Any sport.
I would probably have to say, my favorite player right now, I'd probably have to say right now, is LeBron James. And I know that, you know, people give LeBron James they give him a bad rap about, you know, the decision and that thing. But if you look at his body of work from the time he was 18 years old up until today, where he just signed this massive billion-dollar contract, lifetime contract with Nike, I mean, what has he done? I mean, even the decision was a bad decision how he went about it, but all the money he raised, he gave it back to the Boys and Girls Club. You know, all the people that he has working for him are the guys he grew up with, and he made a pact that, hey, if I make it, you guys are going to make it. Now, granted, everybody's not in that situation because, you know, everybody can't do that, but the fact that he took these guys from Akron and basically they've built this empire, and the way he's gone about doing it, you know, the charity things he does and, you know, the way he plays on the basketball court. And obviously there's some things that, you know, no one's perfect. So obviously, you know, he's made his share of mistakes and, you know, and there's a little bit there, I think, that rubs people the wrong way. But to me, his body of work, I mean, I think he's doing it the right way.
Listen, you're not going to get an argument out of us. I think he is one of the number one players out there.
No, he really can't.
He's awesome. You know, there are so many out there, and it's hard to choose. So sorry if we put you on the spot, but of course we need to know what was your favorite city to play in.
Yeah, New York by far. I mean, I you know, obviously made my career, made my bones in Kansas City, but I mean, there's something about playing in New York City. I mean, I remember going to our last AFC Championship game and just having every last single media outlet in the locker room. I'm literally like, there was probably 200 or 300 cameras in the locker room, and it's like, oh my goodness, like this is like no other city has to deal with that. But you know, if you can play in New York City, you can pretty much play anywhere because it's the pressure, it's the stress, it's the, you know, the expectations, is, you know, and the fans, Jet fans are very passionate fans. And so it was great to be a part of that. And, you know, it's interesting. Like, I only played for the Jets for 3 years, but I have, you know, so much, like, I guess, like, love and respect, you know, from the fans here in New York that it's just overwhelming sometimes. I mean, you know, I could be, you know, which is strange because you can be walking in Times Square and all of a sudden some random guy just comes up to you or a fan comes up to you and is like, hey, man, T-Rich, thank you for, you know, those years with the Jets. And that, you know, as a player, that you know, especially in a city like New York where there's millions of people, and to have that happen in the city, it's just been very humbling. It's been great.
That's awesome.
And, you know, New York fans, I think New York, Boston, and Philly, their fans are just, they have such a diehard base, and, you know, they're so entrenched in the everyday, especially Jet fans, that's going to be really cool.
Well, you know, and that's one thing I really wanted was, and granted, you know, you can't look back on it, you can't cry over spilt milk, but, you know, the fact that we lost that last game in Pittsburgh with the opportunity to go to the Super Bowl, and I just remember, like, thinking about prior to the game. I was like, if we make it to the Super Bowl and have a chance to win, New York City would be upside down. Like, I was actually in New York when the Giants, you know, won their Super Bowl and the parade and the whole nine. And, you know, the Giants, I'm used to it. They have rings. You know, I did an event with the mayors last night, and someone was telling him, you know, our trophy case. Well, yes, we can't really look in our trophy case. We don't have our last ring was, our only ring was with Joe Namath. So I know for a fact, right, if the Jets are able to win, I mean, you can pretty much might as well shut the city down. This city would be crazy.
Oh, my God. My brother is a diehard Jet fan, and I think he'd be one of those crazy fans out there.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. He's waiting. He, every year, this is their year. Don't you give up hope. You know, he's one of those fans. So.
That's what you have to love that's what you have to love about Jets fans and sports fans in general. You know, it's like, I feel like you always have that hope for next year. It's like, no matter what's going on, you still have hope. New season, the slate has been wiped clean.
And just to add to that, I feel like the New York fans especially, if they're a Giant fan, they're a Giant fan through and through. And the same thing, if they're a Jet fan, the same thing holds true. And then they're not the type, like a lot of these other cities, if their team isn't doing well, and the next thing you know, they're all, you know, New England Patriots, like on Brady's bandwagon, you know. But, you know, I guess that's sports. But here in New York, man, I think you're right. They would turn the city upside down to Jets one.
It's interesting too, where I live in Long Island City. I live right across the street from a firehouse, and it's great. You know, pretty much all the firefighters in the firehouse are Jets fans, and I'll just be walking up and down the street, and they're just like they're like high fiving, even if they lose, they're like, we're gonna get them, and I'm like, dude, I don't even care anymore. But
that's so funny. My goodness. Oh. Unfortunately, this is so much fun. The time has
the food. Okay,
I have a question. So, living here in New York City, favorite food, favorite restaurant?
That's gonna be a tough one. I probably have to say, if I'm going to, I'll give you my top three. And this, I don't know, it's kind of tough. So I guess so. My favorite sushi restaurant, I would say, is Blue Ribbon Sushi down in Soho.
Great choice.
Love Blue Ribbon. Yeah, I love Blue Ribbon. I'd probably say, if I was going on a date, I'd probably go to Bobo. Bobo's in the West Village.
Excellent place.
Yeah, love Bobo. If I'm going to like an all out, like, you know, fancy dinner, then obviously you'd have to say Per Se.
Yeah, nice. Very nice. What time do you need me there on Saturday? Tony, that was funny. You're supposed to laugh.
Okay. So my go-to restaurant, and obviously because you know, I'm a huge yoga guy, I do yoga at Equinox in Soho. So I'd probably have to say the Dutch is probably like my everyday like go-to restaurant that I really enjoy.
Awesome,
excellent. Yeah. Tony, thank you so much for joining us today. It was such a pleasure to have you on the show, and we look forward to having you join us again very soon. And update us on all the amazing things you're working on.
And before I let you go, for all of our listeners, be sure to follow Tony on social media. You can find him on Facebook at facebook.com/Antonio.Richardson75491, on Twitter at 49TRich, and Instagram, TonyRichNY. And also to learn more about Rich and Spirit Foundation and Dictionary Project, visit www.thedictionaryproject.org, and all of those links are also up on the Live with MJ page, so make sure you guys go and follow him and check everything out.
And I want to thank all of you for joining in today, and be sure to check out our Live with MJ Facebook and Twitter accounts to get updates on our upcoming shows. Tony, enjoy the rest of your week.
We love you, Tony.
We love you. We look forward to seeing you soon. All right.
We got to go for sushi here soon again.
All right, Blue Ribbon. Let's go. Let's do it.
I'm up for it.
Okay. Take care.
All right.
Have a good one.
All right. Thank you, guys. Okay. Bye-bye.